Coming up, Lucky Severson reports on the debate over solitary confinement. Is it wrong, necessary, or something in between? And the Oscar-nominated movie, Philomena. It's based on the true story of an Irish Catholic woman's search for the son she was forced to give up for adoption. I talk with the real-life Philomena about overcoming anger and shame.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Debates over gay rights dominated headlines this week. After strong pressure from all sides, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer vetoed a controversial bill that would have given business owners the right to refuse service on religious grounds. Religious advocates of gay rights had denounced the bill, claiming it discriminated against gays and other groups. They welcomed the veto as a victory for civil rights. The state's Catholic bishops and many evangelical groups had urged Brewer to sign the bill. The Conservative Family Research Council called the veto a blow to religious freedom. In Texas, a federal judge struck down the state ban on same-sex marriage, although the ruling won't take effect pending an appeal. The Texas ruling follows a series of similar decisions in other states, including Oklahoma, Utah, and Virginia. American support for same-sex marriage has risen dramatically in the last decade, according to a new survey out this week. The report from Public Religion Research Institute found overall approval of same-sex marriage has jumped 21% since 2003, with 53% of Americans now favoring it. Support within religious groups is also rising. White evangelicals are still the most opposed to same-sex marriage, but even so, the number of them who say it's against their religious beliefs dropped from 84% to 78%. And there's a big generation gap. The number of white evangelicals between 18 and 33 who oppose gay marriage is 54%. Religious leaders continue to appeal for prayers about the crisis in Ukraine. A prominent archbishop in the Ukrainian Catholic Church traveled to Rome this week seeking solidarity from the Vatican in Europe. He warned that what happens in Ukraine will touch the entire world. Many Ukrainian Catholic and Orthodox clergy had supported the protesters during 3 months of anti-government demonstrations. Oleksandr Turchynov, the man appointed acting president of Ukraine last Sunday, is a Baptist pastor. Protestants make up just 2% of the population there. The United Nations has again this week condemned the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria. At a special briefing, the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees said that 5 years ago, Syria was the world's second largest refugee-hosting country. But today, Syrians are poised to replace Afghans as the world's biggest refugee group. He warned that if current trends continue, the number of Syrian refugees may be 4 million by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the international community called on Syria to comply with a new Security Council resolution demanding open access to aid. Many areas inside Syria have been cut off by the fighting. This week, dramatic pictures were released of thousands gathering to receive food from a UN delivery at a refugee camp in Damascus. Aid officials said the scale of suffering there was devastating. For both Eastern and Western Christians, this coming week marks the start of Lent, the season of fasting and penitence that leads to Easter. Pope Francis released a special message for Lent, urging Christians to use the period to confront poverty and take practical steps to alleviate it. It was another busy week for the Pope. On Monday, Francis made sweeping changes to the Vatican's scandal-plagued financial system. As part of the reforms, he created a new watchdog office, the Secretariat for the Economy, which will be headed by Australian Cardinal George Pell. Friday marked the one-year anniversary of Pope Benedict XVI stepping down from the papal office. At the time, he said he would stay largely, quote, hidden from the world. Benedict lives at the Vatican, and last weekend, he made his first appearance at a public liturgy since his resignation. He said Francis had invited him to the ceremony where new cardinals received their red hats. In Washington, Muslim activist groups and Burmese American Muslims rallied in front of the embassy of Myanmar, calling for an end to the persecution of the minority Rohingya Muslim population. They urged U.S. officials to take stronger action to support religious freedom inside the predominantly Buddhist Myanmar. Hundreds of people, mostly Muslims, have been killed in Myanmar's sectarian violence. The Food and Drug Administration this week debated whether to greenlight testing of controversial new technology that would use the DNA of three parents to create a human embryo. Scientists say that could help prevent inherited diseases. However, there are ethical concerns that it could lead to the creation of so-called designer babies. The technology has been successfully tested in monkeys. Now the question is whether it would be safe and ethical to use it in humans as well. The national debate over whether some prisoners should be locked up by themselves heated up this week. A Senate subcommittee held a hearing on the practice, and New York became the largest state to curb the use of solitary confinement, particularly for minors, disabled individuals, and pregnant women. Meanwhile, a growing faith-based group is mobilizing against solitary confinement. At an event on Capitol Hill, a broad range of religious leaders joined former prisoners to speak out against the practice. Many called it inhumane and said it violates the teachings of their faiths. Lucky Severson took a closer look at the debate over solitary confinement. Is it wrong, necessary, or something in between?
On any given day, it's estimated that there are about 80,000 Americans locked in a small cell for 23 hours or more per day. It's known as solitary confinement, sometimes called segregation, restricted housing, or if you're one of the inmates, flat time, or the hole.
Imagine yourself locked in a closet.
Heather Rice Minas is with the Faith-Based Justice Fellowship, which is part of the Prison Fellowship Ministries. It takes a position, as do several other religious organizations, that solitary confinement is an unchristian practice. Researchers have found that it often does more harm than good.
Many of the people that they worked with who were held in solitary confinement experienced paranoia, hallucinations, depression. Some reacted eventually with violent, uncontrollable anger.
Bobby DeLello knows what it's like. He was in solitary for over 5 years.
It was a horror show. You go insane in there. You go crazy. You hear guys saying, yeah, hello, well, what? The ventilator called his name. The thing that really scared me in there is I was watching my humanity and compassion slipping out of my grasp.
John Russer is chairman of the Washington, D.C. Corrections Officers Union. He thinks, as do many prison guards nationwide, that solitary is getting a bad rap. It's necessary to preserve the safety of inmates and guards within the prison.
I do not see how you could run a prison system at all without some type of segregation, and I don't prefer to use the term solitary. Solitary, yes. I think that just has too many negative connotations.
Solitary certainly has a negative connotation with Bobby DeLello. He was sent to prison for 40 years after an armed robbery. DeLello ended up in solitary for trying to escape.
5 years and 1 month for escaping. Nobody got hurt. I embarrassed the Department of Corrections.
When DeLello got out of prison, he volunteered to work with the Quaker program focusing on prisoners' rights. Ironically, it was the Quakers who first introduced solitary confinement, thinking it would give the guilty some time by themselves to feel sorrow for their actions. Now the Quakers are working to abolish solitary. Mississippi Corrections Director Christopher Epps is trying to do his part. His conversion occurred in 2007.
It was a real bad year. Worst year that I ever had since I've been in correction, which is 32 years.
The Mississippi Department of Corrections had a serious problem at the state's Supermax prison, an outbreak of inmate violence, stabbings, killings, suicide. But instead of putting the prison on total lockdown, which is what usually happens, the corrections commissioner took a giant leap.
This was a major decision. I mean, to take individuals that have been locked up for years and take them from a single cell and put them in a general population unit, it was a major decision.
And not one that was politically popular in an election year in a state that prides itself as being tough on criminals. The commissioner, who once locked 1,000 inmates in solitary, removed 700 to the general prison population, and violence inside the prison went down 40%.
I have watched inmates placed in a single cell, and over a period of time, I watched a mental capacity change severely. I think that if you treat them like animals, that's exactly the way they behave.
The hate, anger, and rage was totally out of control. It's hard to explain to you, but cutting God's heads off in my mind and rolling them down the corridor, that was relieving to me.
But many corrections officers say that's precisely why you need solitary, to house the really bad guys, the assaulters, the rapists, the crazies.
You work in a solitary, no matter where it is, the chances of your being assaulted are through the roof, the chances of having bodily fluids thrown on you. I mean, you are in there in a very, very volatile situation.
The top reasons for placing someone when they look at the records of the disciplinary infraction of why the person went there are not because of significant safety risks, but are actually refusing an order, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, just minor rule
being
violations, being a nuisance.
What all sides agree on is that there are far too many people in prison who are mentally ill, who need help. And that's especially true in solitary.
I guarantee you that the district's jail is the largest mental health provider in the District of Columbia. I guarantee it.
For those in solitary, the question is, are they put there because they're mentally ill, or does solitary cause mental illness?
In today's world, we're getting so many mental health people walking through the door that in some cases it's protective custody, in some cases they're out in the general population and acting out, and it's causing problems.
We're locking people up in solitary confinement to prevent this violent behavior, and in fact it may actually instigate because of the impact on their mental health, even more violent behavior.
Anti-solitary activists say it's not uncommon for prisons to release an inmate directly from solitary to the community. A study in Washington State showed that those inmates are far more likely to commit more crimes.
There is a perception that solitary confinement equals safety, whereas I would argue solitary confinement equals a threat to public safety.
97% of the people in prison today are coming to the street. The real question is, how do you want them back in the street, better or worse than they went in? They're coming out worst.
What's driving the effort to seriously cut back on solitary confinement as much as anything else is money.
In this state, it costs a little bit over twice. It's about $102 a day, and a regular inmate is about $41.51 a day. Everything, for the most part, is room service. You bring his meal to him. You bring his medication to him.
We requested an interview with officials at the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which houses over 12,000 inmates in solitary. They declined the interview, but they have stated their position publicly at a Senate hearing in 2012. Then the Bureau's director said the use of restricted housing or solitary remains a critical management tool. Few argue that solitary should be abolished altogether. Mississippi Commissioner Epps still has about 300 inmates in segregation out of over 22,000 in state prisons. He recommends that inmates in solitary be reviewed every 7 days by an impartial committee. The man who spent more than 5 years of his life in solitary agrees.
When you got an individual that was really, out of control, where'd you put him? Okay, you have to put him in a segregation unit. But that doesn't mean you have to keep them there for years and years and years. Don't just put them in there and weld the door shut.
When the Mississippi commissioner closed the state's supermax segregation unit, it saved the state nearly $6 million annually. That's one reason Commissioner Epps, who is now president of the American Correctional Association, has become a Pied Piper against solitary confinement as he travels around the country.
We have to, I think, stop talking about tough on crime and get smart on crime. And so you and our tax dollars can be spent the way it was meant to be spent instead of trying to impress someone.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Jackson, Mississippi.
In other news, the founding pastor of the world's largest Pentecostal church has been convicted of embezzlement and sentenced to 3 years in prison. The Assemblies of God-affiliated Yoedo Full Gospel Church in South Korea has more than 1 million members. Founder David Yonggi Cho was convicted of embezzling $12 million of church funds. His sentence was suspended. At this year's Academy Awards, the movie Philomena is up for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture. It's based on the true story of a Catholic teenager in Ireland who became pregnant outside of marriage in the 1950s and was forced by nuns to give up her son for adoption. It depicts her search for him decades later, helped by a British journalist. I had the opportunity to sit down with the inspiration for the film, Philomena Lee, and her daughter, Jane Liberton. And, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie yet, we do give away a couple key plot points. The movie starring Judi Dench as the title character has fictionalized some details, but Philomena Lee says it tells her story. Now 80, she believes the film puts a spotlight on the realities for thousands of Catholic unwed mothers in Ireland who still carry guilt and shame half a century later.
You've got to remember, it's 1952, the 50, very early 50s. Life was completely different then, you know, I mean, complete to now, nowadays. And I ended up becoming pregnant, and as I say, it was in those days it was the most awful thing to become pregnant out of wedlock.
Lee was educated by nuns and says she was ignorant about the facts of life when she got pregnant at 18, the first time she had sex. Her family disowned her, and she was sent to a convent-run home for mothers and babies.
We were completely ostracized, but of course, in my religion then, it was classed as a very serious mortal sin in those to have a baby out of wedlock. So, and of course, families were shamed as well.
Lee stayed at the Abbey for the next 3.5 years, raising her son, Anthony, working in the laundry there, and being made to do penance for her sin. She says some of the nuns were harsh, but others were kind, including the one who alerted her just before Christmas that Anthony was being taken away.
I ran up the stairs with her and looked out the window, and there he is going off in the car. And all I could see, the back of the window, was his face. And that's my one memory that I never will forget.
They told her he was going to a good Catholic home in America, but she was devastated.
My lovely little boy was gone. I was so upset, angry, crying all over Christmas. I couldn't stop, I couldn't eat. And the nuns, they got a bit fed up with me, I think, saying I should be grateful he went to a good home.
After she left the Abbey, Lee went on to become a psychiatric nurse. She got married, had a daughter, Jane, and another son. About 10 years ago, she finally told Jane about Anthony.
I said, do you want me to try and find him? I think, first of all, you kind of went... No, because, again, the shame and the, you know,
shame.
Like, because it had been such a secret, and then immediately said, do you think you can?
Liberton uncovered some details, but says they were stonewalled by nuns at the Abbey who refused to give out information. Eventually, they connected with a journalist, Martin Sixsmith, who helped find more answers.
Now we're getting closer. All these years wondering whether Anthony was in trouble or in prison or goodness knows where. As long as I didn't know, I could always tell myself he was happy somewhere and that he was doing all right.
They learned that Anthony, whose adopted name was Michael Hess, had become a high-powered lawyer in Washington, D.C. And sadly, they discovered that he had died of AIDS in 1995 and that he had been trying to find Philomena as well.
And I thought, oh, losing him a second time again. That was the second time I'd lost him, really.
That was a pretty terrible evening, wasn't it?
An awful evening, I tell you.
Lee says in the years after Anthony was taken, she did harbor some anger and bitterness which challenged her religious beliefs. But she says she ultimately hung on to her faith.
I was brought up in nuns all my life, so I believed everything we were told, and that was it. But I did lose a little bit after I left, when I lost Anthony. Oh God, how could they do this to me? But, I mean, they were doing what they thought was right.
You have retained your faith, though, all the
way
through.
Oh, I have, very much so.
All
yeah.
the way through.
I do still believe, and I still retain a lot of my faith.
She says her work at the psychiatric hospital also helped her overcome her bitterness.
I saw so much hurt and so much pain caused through anger in the psychiatric hospital in those days. It was something that was so tragic and so sad that I gradually put my own anger behind me and gradually thought, well, it's no good keeping up like this. And it all happened 60, 70 years ago, you know, so. And you can't go. I couldn't go through life being angry.
But lingering shame has been more difficult to let go.
I was going to ask you, Martin, if it would be possible not to use my real name when you write the story. Perhaps you could call me Nancy. I've always loved that name, Nancy. I have a niece called Nance. Oh, no, maybe they think it's her.
Lee says she was initially reluctant to go public with her story.
It's the shame of it all. It was terrible. You have no idea what it was like in those days. But anyway, I said, no, perhaps maybe if I come up with my story, maybe we'll help other women that were like me, you know, that maybe get the courage to come out and try and find their children as well.
Some critics have objected to the way nuns in the film were portrayed, especially in how they refused to release information to either Philomena or Anthony. But Lee and Liberton say the story is not meant to be an attack on the Catholic Church.
Although the nuns took you in and took care of you, they may have been the solution at that time, but the church itself was also part of the problem. But it was never intended to be an anti-Catholic film
never.
At all. And I don't think it is. I mean, the way Judy plays you and your character throughout the film, it does show that you retain your faith all the way through it.
On February 5th, Lee and Liberton brought their real-life story to the Vatican, where they had a chance to meet Pope Francis.
I felt so forgiven as all them years ago. I mean, it was such an awful sin to have a baby out of wedlock. It made me feel so good inside because I carried the guilt for 50 years.
Lee and Liberton have now teamed up with the Adoption Rights Alliance to launch the Philomena Project, which urges churches and the Irish government to open up adoption records, which are still, by law, closed.
Ultimately, we hope that it might help change the legislation in Ireland because it's very difficult to get any information. You don't have an automatic right to find out who you were if you were adopted.
Although her own story didn't have the happy ending she hoped for, Lee says she takes comfort in knowing Anthony asked to be buried by the abbey where he was born in hopes that one day his mother would find him.
I know it was a sad way to find him. He died, but knowing that he did so desperately try to find me, and so I put some closure and I feel so within my heart, so at peace, because I know up there he's watching over me.
On our calendar, Saturday is the Tibetan New Year. On Sunday, Baha'is begin their 19-day fast when they abstain from food and water from sunrise to sunset. And as I mentioned earlier, Eastern and Western Christians begin the observance of Lent. In the Eastern tradition, Great Lent begins with Clean Monday. For Western Christians, Lent begins on Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, when they traditionally receive a mark of ashes as a symbol of penitence and a reminder of human mortality. In the U.S., there's a growing trend of taking the ritual to the streets, or as some people call it, ashes to go. We followed along last year as Washington, D.C. Episcopal leaders distributed ashes at a busy metro stop. Reverend Nathan Humphrey, former priest in charge at St. Paul's Parish K Street, was our guide.
We're offering the imposition of ashes on Ash Wednesday to the commuters and neighbors here in Foggy Bottom and the students at George Washington University. To remind them that this is the beginning of Lent and a very holy day and a special day. We impose ashes by saying, remember that you are dust and to dust you shall return. We also add, remember that you're loved by God and to God's love you shall return. So it's a reminder of our mortality and an invitation to live a holy Lent, both individually and in relationship with the church. We've been getting a lot of gratitude from people, and that's been really what struck me. And a couple of people have had tears in their eyes that they've received the ashes and a blessing. We're just here to make a witness to the love of God and Christ for us.
In the days leading up to the somberness of Lent, many places around the world hold festive parties, often with costumes. In Italy this week, one small boy wore his costume to St. Peter's Square for the general audience with Pope Francis. The Pope seemed amused at meeting his mini-me. The little boy, not so much. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where I have a fan page too. You can watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Lamb's Church in New York City, one of the houses of worship we'll be featuring in a story scheduled for next week.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.